WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, soul singer Gladys Knight talks about Motown, the Pips, and starting her recording career when she was still in high school. She has a new recording out this month. The new A&E courtroom drama, 100 Center Street, stars Alan Arkin as Judge Joe Rifkin. We'll hear from Arkin and from Sidney Lumet, who's directing many of the episodes. And Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, In the Mood for Love, from Hong Kong filmmaker Wong Kar-wai. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush kept up his push for tax cuts today. He met with congressional Democrats at the Capitol, then addressed Republicans at a retreat in Williamsburg, Virginia. NPR's Chad Pergram reports.
Mr. Bush has made tax cuts one of the early touchstones of his administration. Speaking to Republicans, the president called for an across-the-board $1.6 trillion tax reduction covering a decade.
I come from the school of thought that by cutting marginal rates for everybody who pays taxes is a good way to help ease the pain of what may be an economic slowdown.
But Democrats remain skeptical. Montana's Max Baucus, the ranking minority member on the Senate Finance Committee, said he appreciated the president's congeniality at the Democrats' meeting, but Baucus called the visit all form and no substance. Mr. Bush pleaded with the Democrats not to declare his tax cut package dead on arrival. The White House begins a major public relations offensive to sell the tax reduction package next week. Chad Pergram, NPR News, Washington.
The Agriculture Department has temporarily banned imports of beef from Brazil because of worries about mad cow disease. The ban follows a similar action by Canada. The USDA said there's no evidence that the brain-damaging disease has spread to Brazil, but it has requested information from Brazilian officials so it can complete a risk assessment. Brazilian officials complained that the ban was scientifically unjustified. Canada said it was banning Brazilian beef products because Brazil imported live cattle from Europe until 1999. The human form of mad cow disease is blamed for more than 80 deaths in Europe. Several polls published in Israel show Prime Minister Ehud Barak trailing challenger Ariel Sharon by as much as 21 points. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
Israel's election for prime minister is next Tuesday, and Ehud Barak vowed today that he would begin to close the enormous gap he faces. Over the past few weeks, opinion polls have consistently shown Sharon, the leader of the right-wing Likud party, with a huge lead. Barak's campaign was dogged by the possibility that Nobel Peace Prize winner Shimon Peres might get into the race, but last night the deadline passed for new candidates. At a campaign stop today, Sharon said the election is not yet in his pocket and pledged there would be no negotiations with the Palestinians while Israel is under threat of violence. Barak told Israeli media that only he can bring peace with the Palestinians and that a Sharon victory would result in the most extremist government in Israel's history. There has been little traditional campaigning, and Sharon has refused to debate Barak. The contest has been fought mainly through television ads. Mike Schuster, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 120 points, or 1%, to close at 10,864 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 122 points, or 4.4%, to close at 2661. This is NPR. Emergency officials in India say the death toll from last week's earthquake has risen to at least 15,000. Officials are appealing for aid for the hundreds of thousands of people left homeless by the disaster. Seven U.S. Air Force cargo planes are scheduled to deliver relief supplies to the region tomorrow. Indian police have arrested an astrologer who allegedly caused a panic by predicting that another earthquake would soon hit the region. The University of Michigan's closely watched measure of consumer confidence fell again in January. Steve Beckner of Market News International reports.
With unemployment rising last month, the index of consumer sentiment fell from 98.4 to 94.7. Expectations as well as assessments of current economic conditions weakened. Consumer confidence is getting more than the usual amount of attention these days because of the high stakes Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan has placed on it. So far, he said, growth has slowed to very close to zero. But whether the economy slides into outright recession will depend on whether there is a breach in consumer confidence. 2 days ago, the Fed cited eroding confidence as a main reason for cutting interest rates a half percentage point for the second time in a month. More positively, the Commerce Department said December factory orders rose 1.1%. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
The United Nations is appealing to the international community to help refugees from the warfare and drought in Afghanistan. UN relief officials say several hundred thousand refugees are crowded into camps in western Afghanistan and Pakistan, and many are dying from cold and disease. Officials say there are not enough tents, blankets, or warm clothes to help the refugees. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novosoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we present an onstage interview with the great soul singer Gladys Knight. Gladys Knight recorded her first hit, Every Beat of My Heart, in 1961 when she was still in high school. In 1966, she started her 8-year stay at Motown, where her hits included The End of Our Road, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, If I Were Your Woman, and Neither One of Us. In the mid-70s, she sang deeply affecting adult ballads like You're the Best Thing That Ever Happened to Me and Midnight Train to Georgia.
So he's leaving the life he's come to know. Ooh.
He said he's going.
He said he's going back to find.
Going back to find.
Ooh, 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 what's left of his world. The world he left behind. Not so long. Said he's
going back
to a simpler place and time. Oh, yes, he is. Now be with him.
I know you will.
On that midnight train to Georgia.
Even on a midnight train.
I'd rather live in his world than live without him.
Gladys Knight is perhaps the only performer in Motown history who had hits before joining the label and after leaving it. She has a new CD called At Last, which will be released later this month. I spoke with her in 1996, the year she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Our interview was recorded at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco as part of the 15th anniversary celebration of City Arts and Lectures, which presents onstage conversations in San Francisco with leading figures in literature, criticism, and the performing arts.
Now, you were, 17, I think, when you recorded your first hit, Every Beat of My Heart?
16.
Wow.
Yes. That was quite something, too.
Now, you had two versions that
we had
you recorded.
Three
versions. Okay. Now, the first, I believe, was recorded without you realizing that somebody was recording.
That's
it.
Right.
What happened?
Well, we were performing at this club called the Builders Club in Atlanta, and we did weekends there while we were in school. And the gentleman that owned the club came to us one night, and we were friends, and his kids went to school with us and everything. So he came to us one night, and he said, hey, you guys, said, I got some new recording equipment in today, and we're just going to, like, set up a little makeshift studio in the club tonight and just see what kind of sounds we got. So would you guys mind staying over after the show? So green as we were, we said, okay. And when we got to record that night, we did, like, a lot of the hit stuff, the pop stuff that was out at the time. And then he asked us if we had any original material. And we said, oh, yeah, we were excited about it. We were looking forward to the day when we got a chance to record and have our first record out. And, oh, boy, were we ready, right? So we said, yeah, we got one thing we've really been working on. Now, we weren't thinking at that time, this is not the way to do it. This is not the time that you should be protective, okay? So we did this song. The song was Every Beat of My Heart. Okay? So we recorded this song, and when we knew anything, our friends at school started to telling us that we love your record.
And you didn't was a record.
Yes. And they said, you got a record out. I said, is that so? Yeah. And from there, that's how we found out about it. And in the meantime, there was a scout in Atlanta looking for talent. And he had heard this song on the radio, and he asked all around town people how to get in touch with my mom. And he finally found my mom, and they came over and talked to her, and we flew to New York to sign with Bobby Robinson at Fury Records.
And the Fury Records recording became a big hit.
Right, and that's actually how we got the name Gladys Knight and the Pips, because originally we were just the Pips. And I was just one of the lead singers in the group.
Oh.
Okay. And then after we got to New York and we recorded the same song over again, Every Beat of My Heart, then Bobby Robinson suggested, why don't we name our record Gladys Knight and the Pips to distinguish between the VJ and the Hon Tom record, which is just the Pips. So that's how we got Gladys Knight and the Pips started, and it just kind of stuck, and it was Gladys Knight and the Pips from then on.
I have to say that this 1961 recording is an extraordinary recording. You sound so great on it.
Thank
and particularly
you.
When you think that 17 years old or 16 years old.
Yeah.
So, in fact, I think we should listen to some of this recording. Fury Records, Gladys Knight and the Pips. Let's hear it.
Oh, my goodness.
Uncomfortable to
you
hear
are
that,
really, really something. You know, I never really listened to myself then, because you know how you know, you feel it, that your voice is changing and you're going to crack any minute. That kind of thing. So I didn't do a lot of listening to myself during those days. I listen to myself more now. Maybe it's because I'm more into the creative end and I have to. But yeah, that sounds weird.
Now, I've been reading Berry Gordy's autobiography, and I want to just read what he said about you. He said that the first time he saw Gladys Knight and the Pips, he was impressed by their class, artistry, and stage presence. He said, unlike many of our acts who'd been through our artist development process, Gladys and the Pips were already seasoned before coming to town. They'd actually worked with some of our key artist development people earlier in their career, including choreographer Charlie Atkins.
Uh-huh.
So you already had the equivalent of charm school. You had the choreographer
right.
working with you. How did you get into all of that? And what are some of the values? What are some of the stage values that you learned early on?
Well, that also came from my mom and our parents. They surrounded us with these kinds of people. Maurice King. Let me tell you what Barry did, too, by the way. he did like what he saw in us. And no matter what, he did always show us respect, but you needed Barry's personal touch in order to really, really rise, okay? And that's how eventually we got to getting the recognition on the records that we needed. But Barry saw us and liked everything. Do you know that he hired every single person out from under us that worked with us and started artist development? Charlie Atkins was our pops. He was our first choreographer and, so to speak, our entertainment father, because he taught us our etiquette as to what we do and what we don't do in this industry. You know, as far as teaching us how to move on stage and giving us our character and that kind of thing, along with Maurice King, who for many years had been the musical conductor and director at the famous Flame Show Bar in Detroit. So, you know, all of the people that we worked with, he was a friend of my mom, and he coached us when we were little kids, Maurice King.
I know that the Motown process was that there were meetings, I think, every Friday.
Yeah.
And the producers would come with their new songs and their little demos, and then everybody would vote on which was the record that week that was actually going to get made.
They had a lot of control in your life.
Yeah, so how did you feel as a performer? Were you in on those meetings, and did you have any say on your material or who the producer would be, what song you'd do?
No, we didn't quite have that freedom at Motown, and that was another one of my pet peeves, so to speak, you know, is that sometimes it got a little personal, because after all, we are dealing with just human beings making these votes. So maybe that person may not have felt so good about something you did, and they're voting on something that could make or break your career. You know, and it may just go the other way. So, no, I don't like that record. You know, that kind of thing for some personal reason. And that came to play sometimes in that arena. And it's just too important a thing to be decided that way.
We're featuring an interview with Gladys Knight recorded in 1996 at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco. There's more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our onstage interview with Gladys Knight, recorded in 1996.
No, I want you to tell the story of I Heard It Through the Grapevine, one of your great hits.
Yes.
Now, the songwriter and producer of this took it to one of the meetings, and he initially wanted Marvin Gaye to do it.
Yes.
Right? And I think Marvin Gaye was going to sing it more like a ballad.
Really?
That's what Berry Gordy says.
Uh-huh.
That's what Berry Gordy says.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, but... Anyways, Berry Gordy voted it down. He wanted Marvin Gaye to do a different song.
Okay.
And, right, do I have the story right?
Yes.
Okay.
I would imagine. I didn't know the Marvin Gaye story, but I know that the song had been sitting on the shelf and demoed a couple of times, just trying to see what could be done with it. Matter of fact, Barrett, who was one of the writers on the song, Barrett Strong, did it himself. And it was just kind of sitting around. So when the producer... came to us with this particular song, it was like, hey, I really believe in this song, Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong, and just take it and play with it. And we took the song with us on the road, and we were in the hotels. We sit out in the hall and work on our little song and stuff like that. And
can you tell us a little bit how you worked on that song, what the song sounded like before you started working on it, what you put into it that wasn't written in?
Well, we created the whole background. For I Heard It Through the Grapevine. We created the whole background.
Well, the Oh Yes I Do.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. You go, Terry. Yeah. Yep. Yep, we did the, you know, Oh Yes I Am, Oh Yes I Am. Don't you know that I heard it? We did all of those. All of the black background things that you heard, we did those. And what happened was we kind of broke it up. It wasn't quite put together, verse, chorus, like we ended up with it. And so we just tore it apart, put it back together. We would get up in the morning, fix our breakfast while we're planning. We would tape what we had in mind, and eventually we felt we had it right. We ran down to the studio, and we played it for Norman, and he was so excited. He just flipped. I mean, he just... Hey. And Smokey happened to be in the studio. Smokey Robinson happened to be in the studio that afternoon, in Studio A. And we needed a studio because he wanted us to record it right then. And so we went upstairs, and he asked Smokey if we could borrow the studio. And Smokey said, yeah, you know. So we went on in the studio, and we recorded it right then. And it became the biggest selling record Motown had that year. And it became our first number one record. And then along came Marvin. That next year, this was in 1967 for us. 1968, Marvin came out with I Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong, who wrote Grapevine, also wrote a lot of the Temptations songs.
Exactly.
Did you ever have to compete with the Temptations for songs?
Yeah. Matter of fact, another thing that bothered me was that when we first came to the company, all the things that they kind of brought us were things that the other artists had done already.
And they wanted
and
to
cover?
And it was
like hand-me-down stuff. You know, I said, don't we want our own music? You know, that kind of thing. And I remember our very first release from Motown was Everybody Needs Love. Well, the Temptations had worn that out already. You know, I mean, it was a big hit for them. So we had our job cut out for us just to even get any recognition on it, because songs start to belong to people after a while. You know, I mean, a cover, and they're doing a lot of it now, if you've noticed. They're covering everything. I think it's a lack of music, you know, that they're looking for, you know? But I always felt about a cover. I have so much respect for the people that I love that it would be very difficult to do a cover.
So do you feel that your sound or the group's choreography or your image changed much during the Motown years?
Not really. If anything, we got better. And I say this, and I don't mean to offend any of the Temptation fans or lovers out there tonight, but in actuality, the Pip started the fast step, the steps that the Temptations became so known for. The Pips were the first to do that. But the Temptations got the first national recording recognition, so they became known for those fast steps. So on a larger scale, so it started being attributed to them, but in actuality, they used to stand in the wings and watch every move the Pips made. You know, I'm serious.
I believe it.
So
I bet that there isn't a person in the house tonight who hasn't had the fantasy of singing with the Pips behind them.
Yeah! You'd get the best. It's quite an experience, I tell you. It's quite an experience.
Now, you are, as I mentioned before, maybe the only group that was with Motown that had hits before Motown and after Motown.
You know, I heard you say that in the intro.
Is that not right?
Yes, but I never thought about it. I never thought about that. And it's real. It's the truth. since 61. That was, that particular song was also the one we heard, Every Beat of My Heart, was also a very phenomenal record because it ended up on the charts with the number 2 and the number 3 position, the same record, same group. First time in history that ever happened. So, yeah. So, we had music before, and our great record success, even as great or greater, came after we left Motown.
Gladys Knight, recorded in January 1996 at the Masonic Auditorium in San Francisco as part of the 15th anniversary celebration of City Arts and Lectures of San Francisco. The evening celebration was produced by Sidney Goldstein with associate producer Stephen Barclay and production coordinator Margaret Moose Pick. The interview was edited for Fresh Air by Joan Tui Westman, Roberta Shurrock, and Patty Leswing. Special thanks to Bubba Knight. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I've had my share of life's ups and downs, but fate's been kind, but the downs have been few. I guess you could say that I've been lucky. Oh, I guess you could say that it's all because of you. If anyone should ever ride story, for whatever reason there might be, ooh, you'd be there between each line of pain and glory, 'cause you're the best thing that ever happened to me. You're the best thing that ever happened to me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new A&E series, 100 Center Street, is about life on the streets and in the courtrooms of New York City. Coming up, we hear from the series' star, Alan Arkin, and its director and producer, Sidney Lumet. And Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, In the Mood for Love, from Hong Kong filmmaker Wong Kar-wai.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new A&E courtroom drama, 100 Center Street, stars Alan Arkin as Joe Rifkin, a liberal judge in New York City.
Charlie called from downtown. You let some kid go tonight, a Floyd somebody?
Yeah, William Floyd, yes.
He shot a cop. It was a holdup, a bodega. He's in Metropolitan Hospital.
How's the cop?
She's dead, Joe. She was killed right away. She was on her first patrol.
We'll hear from Alan Arkin a little later in the show. Sidney Lumet is a producer of 100 Center Street and is writing and directing many of the episodes. Lumet started his career in television and then became a prolific film director. His movies include Long Day's Journey Into Night, Failsafe, The Pawnbroker, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, and Prince of the City. I spoke with Lumet in 1989. Here's a scene from his first movie, 12 Angry Men, starring Henry Fonda and Lee J. Cobb. Fonda is the only juror initially convinced of the defendant's innocence. Cobb is the last holdout.
Maybe she honestly thought she saw the boy kill his father. I say she only saw a blur.
How do you know what she saw? How does he know all that? How do you know what kind of glasses she wore? Maybe there were sunglasses. Maybe she was farsighted. What do you know about it?
I only know the woman's eyesight is in question now.
She had to be able to identify a person 60 feet away at night without glasses.
You can't send someone off to die on evidence like that.
Oh, don't give me that.
It's a heck of a cast. In addition to Fonda and Lee J. Cobb, you have Jack Warden, Jack Klugman, E.G. Marshall, Ed Begley. You directed them your first time out on film, and you've since directed Paul Newman and younger actors like Al Pacino and Treat Williams. Is there a difference in the acting styles of the actors who you were directing in the 50s and the actors who came of age in, say, the 70s?
Not really, Terry. The basic craft of acting is, in the United States, has been set for some years, really, even before the method came in. Basically, people like Fonda worked out of a profound sense of truth. In fact, a man like Fonda didn't know how to do anything falsely and used himself brilliantly. Both of those elements are foundations of the method, and even though he wasn't called a method actor in the sense of having studied the method, he basically worked out of that, as most good actors did.
Do you think of yourself as a method director?
No, I become the kind of director that becomes whatever his actors need. When I did Murder on the Orient Express, I could work the way the English actors work. When we did Long Day's Journey Into Night, there was a perfect example. Kate Hepburn has a very specific way of working, her own technique. Ralph Richardson is a prime example of British technique, which is primarily from what we call the outside in. Dean Stockwell works completely method from the inside out, and Jason has his own glorious world of creating something from inside himself, and heaven knows where it comes from. But I think part of the job of directing is to not make the actors work your way, but for you to work as a director any way that makes them comfortable.
You directed Al Pacino in two of his first big movie roles, Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. I want to play a short scene from Dog Day Afternoon, and maybe you could tell me what you think Al Pacino needed when he was getting started. This is a scene from the very opening of the movie when Pacino walks into a New York bank and he holds it up and he wants the money to buy a sex change operation for his lover.
Nobody move! Get over there! Okay. All right, get away from those alarms.
Cut!
Now get in the center. He moves. Take his head off. Put the gun on him! Get out of the center.
Sonny? I can't do it, Sonny.
What?
I'm not gonna make it, Sonny.
What are you talking about? Put it on.
I can't do it, Sonny.
Sal! Sal, what? Where are you? He can't make it.
It's an interesting performance because Pacino is so manic in it and yet so insecure and incompetent at robbing this bank.
Mm-hmm.
What did he need when he was getting started? You were talking before about giving actors what you think they need.
Primarily what he needed was, this is going to sound like an anachronism, and it was, he needed a great sense of freedom and a great sense of restriction. That The creation of the character is really Al's own. He understood something about that man that is irreplaceable, and I don't think a director can ever give. He understood him down to his bone marrow. What he needed was a sense of release, the confidence to know that as extreme as he got in the performance, that it would write, that it went. For example, there's a scene toward the end of the movie where he's talking to his female wife, his real wife, on the telephone, trying to decide what to do. And the scene is extraordinary in the sense that it requires a level of emotion that I've seen very rarely in movies. We did the scene in one take with two cameras, because I didn't want him to have to repeat that emotion over and over again. And when he finished it the first time, it was wonderful. And without waiting an instant, I didn't even cut the cameras. I said, "Al, go again." And he looked at me like I was crazy, because he was exhausted. He was spent. And I said, "Right now, action." And what I was driving at was that he had reached such a height at the end of the first take, such an emotional peak, but that's really where I wanted the scene to begin.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the best pieces of movie acting I've ever seen. It was blinding in its intensity, agonizingly painful, and just reached a level of emotion that I don't think I've seen often in movie acting. And that knowledge that he could go as far as he wanted to within the confines of this situation and that man, the situation created by the script, the man created by Pacino, but that confidence to know that he could go as far as his feelings would carry him, was very important to him. And that was really the biggest single directing relationship to his performance.
Now, you're really known for doing a lot of performances on first and second takes, for not going for a lot of takes. I wonder if you ever run into conflicts where there's one actor in a scene who works really well on that first or second take, and another actor who sees it as their style to go for 15 or 16 takes until they really get it perfect. What do you do if you run into that?
I have run into it, and so far, if there were a piece of wood around the studio, I'd knock on it. But so far, I've been able to convince the 15 or 16 take actor that the other works. The early takes are not imperfect. They are usually the freshest, truest. The repetition, I find, and I think for most good actors, the repetitions tend to become mechanical. One doesn't find more truth in it as it goes on. Now, that partially has to do with the way I work, because, as you know, or may know, I rehearse very heavily. I rehearse 2 to 3 weeks, depending on the complexity of the characters, before we begin. And those rehearsals are conducted like theater rehearsals, in the sense that people learn their lines completely, are working without scripts, they're completely blocked, to the degree that we're having run-throughs by the end of it. So it's not as if, once we get on camera, that this is their first exposure.
I want to play another short scene from another movie you directed, and this is Network, which came out in 1976. Peter Finch won a posthumous Academy Award for his performance in this. And in this scene, he plays a lunatic, self-styled, messianic broadcaster who is basically preaching his editorial.
I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crying in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
And right after, as he's doing that editorial, people all over Manhattan in high-rise apartment buildings open up their windows, stick their heads out, and start yelling that they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore. I thought that scene really tapped into something, and for me what it tapped into is the fear is that in Manhattan, Manhattan, there's so many high-rises filled with so many people with all this pent-up anger. And if it was ever let loose, we'd really be in big trouble.
Well, Paddy Chayefsky had that unique ability to tap the most fundamental truths in people, in the individual characters, and also in terms of the situation that he was observing. Did you ever see a picture that he wrote called Hospital?
No, I didn't.
Well, it's hilarious as Network is with fundamentally a deeply serious idea behind it, and he did it in that too. I miss him every day.
Sidney Lumet. He's producing and directing the new A&E courtroom drama 100 Center Street. Our interview was recorded in 1989. Coming up, we'll hear from the star of 100 Center Street, Alan Arkin. This is Fresh Air. Alan Arkin stars as a liberal judge in the new A&E courtroom series 100 Center Street. Arkin has starred in such films as The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, Wait Until Dark, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, Catch-22, The 7% Solution, The In-Laws, Joshua Then and Now, Glengarry Glen Ross, Gattaca, and The Slums of Beverly Hills. I spoke with him in 1989. He told me that before he became an actor, he used to mimic the people he knew.
I used to imitate people on the street. I used to imitate actors that I saw. I used to imitate family members. I used to watch people's behavior in terms of how affected I was from an acting standpoint. So real life became fodder for acting for me, which I think helped my acting, but didn't do my life any good particularly.
So even Thanksgiving dinner was, you'd be there watching how everybody was behaving?
Yeah, how did this person eat? Why am I moved when somebody says something in that way? And why can somebody else say almost the same thing and I'm not moved by them? It doesn't affect me. I was really caught up in that from a very early age on, from the age of 6, 7, 8.
When you were growing up, was there anyone in your family or in your neighborhood who was theatrical in the way they lived their life? I don't mean that they were necessarily on the stage, but they had this sense of the theater of life.
Yeah, oh, very much so. There was a guy named Sam Kennedy who was the husband of my mother's best friend, who was the most flamboyant character I'd ever met. He was right out of Sean O'Casey, and he wore black turtleneck sweaters, woolen ones, without any underwear underneath, and jeans in days when nobody was doing things like that, in the 40s and late 30s. And he was about 6'4 and had a mustache and was a merchant seaman and a sculptor and a guitarist and drank like a fish. And he was the most flamboyant person I think I'd ever met. And
you like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it was very organic. There was nothing artificial about it. It came right from the heart of him.
And any really colorful speakers?
Speakers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my father was always very good verbally, and my grandfather was made speeches for the Masons, so he was very literate. I have a vivid memory of him reading a speech, tears streaming down his face, to a plumber who was, the two of them were in the bathroom, and the plumber, all you could see was his feet sticking out from under the bathtub. He was paying absolutely no attention to my grandfather. And there he was, reading this passionate speech with tears streaming down his face.
So here you were with all of this interest in theater. And when you got, I think it was when you got out of college, in around 1956, you were part of the pop folk group, The Terriers.
Yeah.
And they had a hit that made it onto the charts, actually, of the Banana Boat song and what, Cindy O' Cindy?
Yeah.
It almost seems like you were miscast in that group.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I felt so myself. I ended up after about 2 years being on stage at the Olympia Theater in Paris to an audience of about 3,000. We were singing Hearts on it, and I looked down at myself, and there I was in black satin pants and a sport shirt open to my navel practically, and I said, "Who am I? What am I doing here?" And I quit that night and went back to what I wanted to do, which was be connected with film and theater.
How did you get into the detour of folk music to begin with?
Well, I had gotten out of college and I had gotten married and had a small child at the age of 22, and I needed something to do to just get us going. And there was this group that started, and I thought it would only take up my weekends periodically, and we'd make a little spare change to just survive on it. And within 3 months, we had an enormous hit on our hands, and so we traveled around the world with that for about 2 years, and it just seemed to me that it was the logical thing to do at the time. And I also thought, in my naive fashion, that would be an entree into film and theater, which it wasn't.
Alan Arkin is my guest. Let's talk a little bit about your first feature film, The Russians Are Coming. Earlier you said that when you looked back on this role, you didn't feel like you saw yourself, you saw the character.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play a short clip from the movie, and this is a scene from early on after the Russians have landed in New England, and you've knocked on the door of a family. Carl Reiner's the husband, Eva Marie Saint is the wife, and you're taking them at gunpoint into their home and hoping that they'll help you find a boat.
All the keeping calm, please. Yes. I repeat, no harm is coming. Olna, please, being seated.
It's all right, honey. Just take it easy now, Pete boy. Don't be scared. There's no need to be scared.
I'm not scared.
Good. Good boy. Now, to answer some few questions very quickly, please, so that there is no necessity whatsoever.
Whatsoever.
So that there is no necessity whatsoever why everybody in such a nice American family should get shot to little pieces. You understand? Yes. Good. Now, what else people are in this house?
So that's your first feature role.
Right.
What stage were you in acting then? How did you prepare for that role?
How did I prepare? It was mostly in learning how to speak Russian and thinking a lot about what I wanted to do. I didn't do any research because I didn't know how I could do any research. I wanted to be very comfortable. It was important to be comfortable. It was my first feature, and I knew I was going to be panic-stricken because it's something I'd wanted to do for 25 years, and it was just too big a hunk of my life to relax about.
So you actually studied Russian for the part?
Yeah, for months. I studied Russian with an old woman in New York. Nobody had told me what to do or how to do it. I was left to my own devices, so I worked for months with this woman trying to get the sound. And I was pretty good at languages, but there were sounds in Russian I could not hear. And then finally, after several months, I began to hear the sounds and I got the lines down in Russian. I went on the set and I said my first line in rehearsals proudly. And there were a lot of real Russians on the set. Nobody understood a word I was saying. And it turned out I was speaking a Russian that no one had spoken for about 50 years. It was totally archaic, and I had to, on the set, start over again from the very beginning, which was very unnerving.
So how much of the Russian do you remember?
I can still say my lines. You can wake me up in the middle of the night, and I can do my lines verbatim, and I can't do it with any other film.
But can you talk to a Russian?
Yeah, I can say my lines to him from the film.
I'm sure that's a real help.
Yeah.
Alan Arkin, let's jump ahead to 1985, to your role in the movie Joshua Then and Now. And you starred along with James Woods in this movie. You played James Woods' father, a small-time Jewish gangster and bootlegger. And I want to play an excerpt from a flashback scene in which you're in a gym with your young son and you're teaching him about the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
What do we got here? Quote. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Unquote. Yeah, you see, there was a lot of contenders in those days. Other gods, mainly no account idols, bums of the month, until our God, Jehovah, came in and took the title outright and made a covenant with our people.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, where was I? Yeah, thou shalt not commit adultery. That's... Thou shalt not steal.
Thou shalt not steal?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, there's Ten Commandments. It's like an exam, right? I figure you get 8 out of 10 right. You're pretty much at the top of the class, aren't you?
Was there anyone you knew in life that you could pattern this character
on? Not a soul. No, nobody I knew. I loved that character. The minute I read the script, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with him. And that was it. I told Ted Kotcheff, the director, who was wonderful to work with, I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, fine, go ahead, that sounds good, and that's what I did. I worked out a lot. I got myself in pretty good shape for it, in scenes they never ended up using. So I got into good shape for nothing. For nothing.
What a waste of time.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Well, Alan Arkin, I thank you so much for talking.
Thank you.
You're
wonderful to talk to.
Oh, thanks. I really enjoyed this very much. Alan Arkin recorded in 1989. He's now starring in the new A&E courtroom series, 100 Center Street. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, In the Mood for Love. This is Fresh Air. In the Mood for Love is the latest feature from Hong Kong filmmaker Wong Kar-wai, who first captivated American arthouse audiences with Chungking Express. His new film is the story of a fledgling relationship between a man and a woman whose spouses are having an affair with one another. Film critic Henry Sheehan says the film's haunting beauty and exquisite sense of detail turn a small, intimate tale into a moving, if odd, romance.
Wong Kar-wai was 32 back in 1988 when he made his first feature as Tears Go By, and his star, Maggie Cheung, was 24. Those aren't bad ages to fall in love, and that's what the two seem to have done. Not in the conventional sense. They're married to other people and have never been linked as lovers. But In the Mood for Love, Wong's latest film, marks the fourth time the two have worked together, and you only have to see Wong's highly charged images of Cheung to know there's an erotic current between them, even if it flows only through a camera lens. That knowledge gives an added spark to their new venture because it, too, is about an odd kind of love. The movie is set in Hong Kong in 1962, a time when the colony was particularly crowded and middle-class couples had to scrounge for living space. Cheung's character, Mrs. Chan, takes a room along with her husband in an apartment on the same day that a Mr. and Mrs. Chow are renting their own bedroom in the flat next door. Chan settles in pretty quickly, but not nearly so quickly as her husband. Mr. Chan, it soon turns out, has started an affair with his new neighbor, Mrs. Chow. Chan's husband uses his many business trips to Japan to disguise his wandering ways, a tactic that only temporarily fools his wife. But she, in turn, is clearly aghast at the thought of being exposed as an abandoned wife while she lives in such a crowded environment. We don't watch these developments unfold strictly through Chan's eyes. The movie is just as interested in Mr. Chow, the husband of the adulterous wife. Chow is played by another Hong Kong star, Tony Leung, who is perhaps most famous as the bad guy in John Woo's Hard Boiled, but who also played a lovelorn cop in Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express. So how do two secretive people reveal their problems to one another? The quick route would be through open melodramatic declamation. But Wong takes a more difficult, but ultimately more rewarding and exquisitely beautiful way. Working with his regular cameraman, Christopher Doyle, Wong has shot In the Mood for Love in lustrously dark, rich shades of color. Keeping with the settings and the emotional temperature, the compositions are narrow and cramped. But the dynamic is expansive and explosive, the emotions of the characters pushing out rather than the outside world crowding in. In such an electrified atmosphere, every glance, every touch, every stifled word stands out from the humdrum routine. Chan and Chow become as sensitized towards it as we do, and it's not long before they're feeling each other out. Typically, for the movie's insistence on maintaining mundane realities, their breakthrough occurs after they've spent several days passing each other in their neighborhood's narrow streets, while individually they collect their lonely takeout dinners. Soon the two are acting out their fantasies of their faithless spouse's first night together. They meet in a hotel for their own tryst, but nothing happens. Finally, they settle into a friendship, though not an easygoing one. This all requires an almost exhaustive attention to detail, but it's remarkable how often that detail turns out to be centered on Chung. The actress wears Chung Sams through the movie, those high-necked, nearly sleeveless dresses that are shaped to the body's contour and feature thigh-high slits on the sides. Chung doesn't merely look terrific in these evocative dresses. She uses them to maintain her posture and a strangely affecting walk. The walk is the rhythmic source for the movie's score, an oddly paced tune of melancholy which alternates with period tunes by Nat King Cole. Wong's most effective weapon, though, is simply a close-up on Chung's face. In one scene, Chan tries to catch her husband in her neighbor's room while seeming to be on an innocuous visit. She never gets beyond the door, and she never lets down her mask of innocence. But the camera stays motionless, transfixed by Chung's face as she mouths the sort of inane pleasantries that disguise a broken, heaving heart. It's a moment worthy of Dietrich and von Sternberg, and you can't get any more deliriously romantic than that.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. Here's Nat King Cole from the soundtrack of In the Mood for Love.
Siempre que te pregunto que cuando, como y donde, tú siempre me respondes, quizás, quizás, quizás. Y así pasan los días, y yo desesperado, y tú, tú contestando, quizás, quizás, quizás. Estás perdiendo el tiempo, pensando, pensando, por lo que más tú quieras, hasta cuando, y así pasan los días. Desesperado. Y tú, tú contestando.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Watson Wyatt Worldwide, providing consulting services in employee benefits, human capital management, and HR technologies, on the web at watsonwyatt.com, from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Deep in the Heart, a debut novel about love, motherhood, and family. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Manil Suri tells us about how growing up in a Bombay apartment shared with three other families in a building where a homeless man lived on the stairwell's landing led to the creation of his new novel, The Death of Vishnu. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.